and acting in human history. One, to make himself known, and two, to effectuate advances in the outworking of his plan of redemption. So God speaks and God acts in order to make himself known and in order to effectuate advances in the outworking of his plan of redemption. So there's a very close connection between divine revelation and history. From the beginning to the end, the Bible depicts the redemption of man as something that God accomplishes by working within the context of ordinary human history. If you reflect on the biblical narratives, you remember that Adam and Eve fell into sin in the Garden of Eden through the temptation of Satan. Their sin resulted in alienation from God, from one another, and from the natural world around them. It brought death to them and to their descendants. God, however, spoke and promised that the seed of the woman would be the means by which ultimate victory would be won over Satan and death itself. Genesis 3:15, that great promise of the coming of the seed of the woman. The promise of this seed was the promise of Jesus, who, as we know from subsequent revelation, was God incarnate, that is, God in human flesh, being born of the Virgin Mary. Jesus lived, suffered, died, and rose from the dead in space and time history to redeem fallen humanity, to restore fellowship with God, and ultimately to restore all creation. The historical sections of the Old Testament depict the work of God in human history in bringing to fulfillment the promise of the coming of the seed of the woman. This promise, initially given to Adam, was renewed and amplified when God spoke to Abraham and said to Abraham, "In thy seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed." That's in Genesis 12, verse 3. In addition, Abraham was told that his descendants would become a great nation, that they would sojourn in a land not their own and be afflicted there 400 years, after which God would deliver them and bring them into the land of Canaan, which he had already promised to Abraham and his descendants for their homeland. Subsequent Old Testament historical narratives show how God did indeed deliver the descendants of Abraham from Egypt under the leadership of Moses and Aaron by many miraculous signs and wonders, and how he entered into covenant with them at Mount Sinai, where he spoke again and gave his law amidst the thunderings and lightnings that enveloped the mountain. After suffering 40 years of wilderness journeys because of disobedience, Israel was brought into the land of promise. The history of Israel in the land is, for the most part, a history of continual apostasy and turning away from the Lord, with some few exceptions of times of revival and reformation. You might think of the time of Josiah, the time of Hezekiah. But at the same time, it is a history in which the Lord's long-suffering and covenant faithfulness are repeatedly manifested. In due time, God placed David on the throne as an imperfect yet true representative of the ideal of the covenantal king. David is given the promise that his dynasty will endure forever. And in this promise, the line of that promised seed, which was first given back there in Genesis 3:15, is narrowed down to the house of David and to the tribe of Judah. After Israel's continual disobedience led to her being driven from the land in the time of the exile, even though a remnant eventually was able to return, in the fullness of time, the promised seed came in the person of Jesus, born of Mary, and in the line of Abraham and of David. Now that resume, in an extremely abbreviated form, is the history of redemption, which is depicted for us in the historical narratives of the Old Testament scriptures. In this history, God repeatedly speaks to make his will known. At times, he appears to men in visible form. We call those manifestations of God theophanies. At other times, he demonstrates his power and his sovereignty over nature and history through miraculous signs and wonders. We think of the time of the Exodus when he did that in order to advance his redemptive purposes. Now, in that resume of redemptive history as contained in the Old Testament, there are some things of particular importance for our topic, divine revelation and history in the Old Testament, to which I would like us to give our attention. Number one, revelation in the Old Testament often takes the form of communication from God to man ob extra. I use a Latin term there. Ob extra means from without. Revelation in the Old Testament often takes the form of communication from God to man from without. God spoke to various individuals in an audible voice, perceived by normal sense perception. His revelation is objective, and it is as real as our own verbal communication with each other. It should be noted that not all divine revelation is given in that way, but some is. And that is important. In his book on biblical theology, Gerhardus Voss points out that there is also what may be termed subjective revelation in order to distinguish it from this objective, ob extra form of revelation. There's also subjective revelation, which is, in Voss's words, the inward activity of the Spirit upon the depths of human subconsciousness, causing certain God-intended thoughts to well up therefrom. The Psalms offer examples of this kind of revelation. And although brought up in a subjective channel, Voss says we nonetheless must claim for it absolute divine authority. Otherwise, it would not properly be called revelation. In this subjective form, revelation and inspiration coalesce. They come together. But Voss's next statement, I think, is very important. He says, and I quote, "We must be on our guard against the modern tendency to reduce all revelation in the scriptures to this category of the ob intra." And he uses another Latin term, from within. We must be on our guard against the modern tendency to reduce all revelation in the scriptures to this category of the ob intra, revelation from within. That is usually intended, Voss notes, to deprive revelation of its infallibility. A favorite form is to confine revelation proper to the bare acts of self-disclosure performed by God, and then to derive the entire thought content of the Bible from human reflection upon these acts. End of quote. Now, certainly, I think Voss is correct. That is, indeed, a modern tendency. Perhaps even more pronounced today than it was when Voss wrote his biblical theology, which was in the first half of the 20th century. So first of all, we want to make it very clear that when we think about divine revelation and history in the Old Testament, revelation in the Old Testament often takes the form of communication from God to man ob extra, from without. We need to hold on to that. Secondly, although revelation is not to be confined to the bare acts of divine self-disclosure, or limited to simply acts of God, such acts did occur and may in themselves have revelatory significance. Because revelation is closely connected with the history of redemption, in a number of instances, revelation becomes identified with history or to use again a term that Voss uses, it becomes incarnate in history. Revelation becomes incarnate in history. To put it a bit differently, besides using words, God also employed acts to reveal great principles of truth. What Voss has in mind when he discusses this is not just prophetic visions or miracles, but the great outstanding acts of redemption, such as the deliverance of the Israelites out of Egypt. And in the New Testament, acts such as the crucifixion of Christ and the resurrection of Christ. In such instances, history itself is revelatory. There is in such acts themselves, as Voss suggests, a self-disclosure of God. Now this means that there are instances where act revelation must be considered in addition to word revelation. We already talked about word revelation. Now we're talking about revelation through event or through act. Now, it should be noted that this emphasis on revelation through act or event needs to be qualified. And it is rightly qualified by Voss in a twofold manner. First, when revelation and the redemptive acts of God coincide, Voss says, the primary purpose of such acts is not revelation, even though that may be an important and an essential aspect of their purpose. It's not their primary purpose. Voss says, and I quote, primarily, they possess a purpose that transcends revelation, having a Godward reference in their effect, and only in dependence on this, a manward reference for instruction. Thus, for example, the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ primarily serve a purpose in reference to God. Christ died to satisfy divine justice, so that it would not be proper to view that act of the crucifixion of Christ exclusively or even primarily under the function of revelation. Yet, Voss holds, and I think correctly, that the revealing element in such acts is essential. The two ends of satisfaction and revelation being combined into one, so that the act does have a revelatory function or purpose, even if it's not its primary purpose. Now, that's one way in which Voss qualifies revelation through act or event, that the primary purpose of such acts is not revelation, even though it may serve that purpose. But secondly, and I think even more importantly, he adds another qualification on his emphasis on revelation through act or event. And that is to point out that act revelations are never left entirely to speak for themselves. Act revelations are never left entirely to speak for themselves. Voss emphasizes that the revelatory acts of God never appear separated from his verbal communications of truth. In other words, word and act always accompany each other. Usually, when you look at the scriptures, and particularly at Old Testament history, you will find the act is preceded by and then followed by word revelation. Voss comments, to apply the Kantian phraseology to a higher subject, without God's acts, the words would be empty. Without his words, his acts would be blind. I think that's an important statement. Without God's acts, words would be empty. The acts fulfill the words. The acts confirm the words, give substance to the words. But without his words, the acts would be blind. How would you know the significance and meaning of these divine acts in history if we did not have word revelation? A look at Exodus, I think, is very helpful in this regard. If you look at the first 12 chapters of Exodus, and I'm not going to turn there and go through it with you, I think you're generally familiar with the narratives in Exodus 1 to 12, that are the narratives concerning the bondage in Egypt and God's call of Moses and giving him the commission to go down to Egypt and deliver Israel from Egypt. And then as Moses fulfills that, the series of signs and wonders in the form of the plagues that are given, culminating in the death of the firstborn and not only the Exodus, but the expulsion of the Israelites from Egypt. When you look at Exodus 1 to 12, I think in this connection of act and word revelation, you find something very instructive. You find, first of all, that the word of God comes first, and the deed of God follows. God announces what he's going to do beforehand, and then what he says actually comes to pass. So revelation in Exodus 1 to 12 is not contained in a word that arises by interpretation from a deed or an event or an act. It's not something that arises by interpretation. Revelation consists in a word that is subsequently confirmed by an act, so that the words and acts of God fit together in this snug system of confirmatory revelation, whereby God commits himself verbally to what he proposes to do, and then he confirms that as a veracious word by doing precisely what he said he would do. Now, those today of what you might term the revelation in history school, and what I mean by that is there are people today who would say that all divine revelation is revelation that simply comes to us through historical events. There is no such thing as word revelation. We have to look at history and derive from history significance and meaning. So those of the revelation in history school of approach who would limit divine revelation to the medium of event do not take sufficiently into account the important role of word revelation, which is, in fact, I think, indispensable for divine revelation in history to be perceptible with any degree of certainty and clarity. In other words, if you simply look at history and try from history to elicit significance and meaning with respect to divine revelation, you're faced with a great mystery. One person will say the meaning is this, another person will say the meaning is that. And for perspicuity and clarity, you need that word revelation that gives to us by divine word the significance of these events. Now, there's perhaps no issue in contemporary biblical and theological studies that is more important than a correct understanding of the relation between divine revelation and history. Or to look at that issue from another perspective, you could speak of the relation between faith, which after all is the human response to divine revelation, the relationship between faith and history. So you're looking at the other side of the same coin. But the issue is, what is the relation between divine revelation and history? What is the relation between faith and history? It's an extremely important topic in modern theology. During the time of the Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason, as it is sometimes called, those are terms that are used to describe the mainstream of thought in 18th century Europe. During that time, serious questions were raised about the biblical representation of God speaking and acting in human history. The scientific and intellectual developments of that time fostered belief in natural law and confidence in human reason. A rational and scientific approach to religious, social, and political issues developed, and that promoted a secular view of the world. Of course, we're living with the results of that today. That intellectual climate fostered a new approach for the study of the Bible as well. And that new approach to the study of the Bible was characterized by at least three important and interrelated developments. And we live with the results of these today. First, this is arising out of that age of reason, the rationalism that what developed in the 1800s in Europe, 17 and 1800s, and on into the 1900s in the 20th century. First, there was a strong reaction against any form of supernaturalism. The idea was that reason, not revelation, was the source of all truth. This destroyed the authority of the Bible as divine revelation. Moral norms were not sought in God's law, but in human reason and conscience. So first of all, this strong reaction against any form of supernaturalism. Secondly, there was the development of a new hermeneutic. Hermeneutic is a principle of interpretation, a new principle of interpretation with respect to Scripture. And that new hermeneutic is what is called the historical critical method. Those who utilized that method viewed history as a closed continuum, an unbroken series of causes and effects in which there is no room for supernatural interventions. History is a closed continuum of cause and effect. No room for supernatural interventions. Question.
Do they just take this and say they're not automatically making this
I think they argue on what's observable as far as phenomena that they can point to. I think my next point will get right to that. As Gerhard Hassel summarizes this approach, this historical critical method, he says all historical events must be capable of being explained by antecedent historical causes and understood in terms of analogy to other historical experiences. And that principle of analogy becomes a very big thing. In other words, any event, in order to be recognized as a historical event, you must be able to point to an analogous event. Otherwise, you have reason to question whether the first is really historical.
So
that's right. When those criteria, that is, cause and effect, historical analogy, when those criteria are not met, then according to this hermeneutic of the historical critical method, one can be certain that the event or phenomena being considered did not happen in the way in which it is depicted as having occurred. Now that's the principle of the method. That method was developed. It's a method of looking at history. Thirdly, and you see these things are all interrelated, that reaction against supernaturalism, this closed continuum of history, and arguing by basis of antecedent historical analogy. Thirdly, there was the development of a radical literary criticism of the Bible. Jean Astruc, 1654 to 1766, a French physician, published a work in 1753 in which he proposed that the book of Genesis was to a great extent a composite of what he termed J and E sources. He gets the J from the name Yahweh, for the Lord, Jehovah, E, from the term Elohim. And where one word occurs for God, that's the J source, Yahweh. Where the Elohim word appears, that's the E source. And according to Astruc, these two sources gave alternate versions in Genesis of the same stories. In other words, you'd have a J creation account, an E creation account. You'd have a J flood account, you'd have an E flood account. These have been in the Bible intertwined and intermixed together and included together. He also found numerous other sources in Genesis of less significance. Now, interestingly, Astruc did not deny Mosaic authorship to Genesis in the sense that he considered Moses to be the one who combined the sources. But his theory of distinguishing sources on the basis of different names for God provided a foundation on which later Pentateuchal criticism would build. See, this was way back in 1750. And since that time, that's over 200 years ago, we have the long and complex history of the development of critical theories concerning the composition of the biblical books that really began with that writing of Astruc in the 1750s. But you have this development of a radical literary criticism of the Bible. It begins to analyze and criticize the literature itself and to propose various theories concerning how it was originally composed. Now, under the influences of these three ideas, basically, anti-supernaturalism, the historical critical method, and this literary criticism of the biblical text itself, these ideas that we have been talking about, under the influence of these ideas, the descriptions in the Old Testament of God speaking and acting in human history, in the way in which that is described in the biblical narratives, came to be regarded as something that did not actually happen. So you see, here you get back to this issue of divine revelation in history. The Orthodox view of the Bible was gradually weakened and ultimately abandoned by many. Rejection of biblical supernaturalism and objective divine revelation by word and act left the practitioners of biblical studies who utilized these methods with serious and insoluble problems. The nature of some of these problems can be seen by means of a brief survey of trends in Old Testament studies over the past century. I would like to try to sketch for you some of these trends by means of a very brief survey of the views of three men who, in my opinion, have been the most influential scholars in the area of Old Testament criticism in the past century. Those three men are Julius Wellhausen, who lived 1844 to 1918. Julius Wellhausen, 1844 to 1918. Hermann Gunkel, who lived 1862 to 1932. And then Gerhard von Rad, who lived 1901 to 1971. You have three generations of scholars basically following each other, all of them Germans, all of them extremely influential. First, Julius Wellhausen. Now, it's almost presumptuous to try to summarize the viewpoint of Julius Wellhausen in a couple minutes. He had extremely complex theories, and that goes equally as well for these other two men that I've mentioned. But I'll try to give you just some idea, particularly with respect to this issue of divine revelation in history, what the impact of their ideas were on this particular subject. Julius Wellhausen wedded a documentary source idea of the origin of the Pentateuch to an evolutionary idea of the development of Israel's religious beliefs. Wellhausen believed that all religions develop in an evolutionary pattern, from polytheism to henotheism, which is the idea of a tribal deity, polytheism, many deities, to henotheism, to monotheism. His idea was all religions develop that way. Or to use another scheme that he utilized, he believed all religions develop from natural religion to prophetic religion to priestly religion. You have this natural religion, it's very spontaneous. You have this prophetic religion that follows, and then it eventually gets solidified or codified in a priestly religion with all the rituals that are involved. He then used these J, E, D, and P sources, which were four sources that he isolated in the Pentateuch. He used those four sources to demonstrate that development in Israel by assigning dates to those sources that reflected that alleged development. In other words, he'd separate the material of the Pentateuch, and he'd say, this is an early source, this is a late source, and he'd arrange these sources in this order that seemed to reflect this evolutionary development of Israel's religious beliefs. In the process, he said ideas from later times were projected into earlier periods by the writers of the Old Testament. In other words, you'd have someone writing maybe after the exile, speaking about Abraham, and he'd speak about God's covenant with Abraham. Wellhausen would say, well, covenant's a late, sophisticated religious idea. Nobody living in the time of Abraham ever had that kind of a profound religious concept. That's an idea that was extant in Israel in the time of the exile, projected back into early time. But we know that it's foolishness to think that Abraham ever had such a high God concept as that, because of this naturalistic evolutionary pattern of development of all religions. So he not only said that ideas from later times were projected into earlier periods by the writers of the Old Testament, he also denied the reliability of many historical sections of the Old Testament, and then went further to claim that it included many deliberate fabrications. So you get a very negative attitude toward historical reliability of the Old Testament narratives. Now that approach, of course, was not without consequences for the message of the Old Testament. The major concern of Wellhausen and of his followers ceased to be the message of the Old Testament. It ceased to be what is the meaning of this for us today. But rather, the major concern and interest was to reconstruct by means of the historical critical method what they considered to be the history of Israel's religious development. That was the focus of interest. What is the history of Israel's religious development? And they approached this on the basis of that evolutionary presupposition. Wellhausen himself left his position on the theological faculty at Greifswald, where he was an instructor in the theological faculty, because, as he said in a letter to a friend, he did not feel adequate to prepare students for service in the Protestant church. Now, unfortunately, many of the students of Wellhausen did not follow his example, and they continued to teach and to teach Wellhausen's theories in the context of theological schools and seminaries. The second man I mentioned was Hermann Gunkel, 1862 to 1932. Hermann Gunkel did not abandon the source documents of Wellhausen, but he directed his attention to what he viewed as the antecedent oral traditions that lay behind Wellhausen's documents. In other words, Wellhausen talked about this J document, E document, D document, P document. Gunkel said, all right, I'll accept your analysis that these documents exist, they can be isolated, labeled, and so forth. But he wasn't really so much interested in the documents themselves. He wanted to go back beyond the documents to what he considered to be an oral tradition that had eventually become fossilized or written down in the documents. And he developed what has come to be known as form criticism. Wellhausen practiced what is been termed literary criticism. Gunkel wanted to practice what he termed form criticism. He did this by isolating story units, attempted to determine their literary genre, what literary type is the story unit, and then positing a situation in life, to use the German term, a Sitzimleben, that produced that particular literary form. And he felt all this took place in an oral form prior to its being put down in written form. Now, according to his analysis, most of the narratives of Genesis are to be classified as various types of legends. He wrote a book called The Legends of Genesis. Now, I'm not going to dwell so much on that, but what I want to point out here is that right at this point, there's a significant difference between Gunkel and Wellhausen that becomes apparent. Even though Gunkel viewed the stories of Genesis as legend and not history, he felt that he was still able to preserve their religious value and their meaning, because for Gunkel, what actually happened is not the important thing in a legend. But the message conveyed by the story is what is significant. For Gunkel, the narratives of Genesis are not history, they're legend. But he doesn't want to lose the religious value and meaning of them. So he says, with a legend, what happens not important, but the message conveyed by the story is the significant thing. He says, and I quote, "Think of the force with which in the Cain story murder is set forth as the basal crime. Think of the charm of the Joseph story, eloquent of fraternal envy and fraternal love, and so full of faith in an overruling providence." And he goes on with that sort of an analysis of significance or meaning for these legends. So even though Gunkel abandoned the historical value of the Old Testament, he tried to hold on to its religious moral value. Now that represents, I believe, a reaction setting in against the attitude generated by the Wellhausen school, in which the religious value of the Old Testament was swallowed up by his purely literary and history of religion approach. He wasn't interested in meaning or value. He was interested in the history of the development of Israel's religion. Gunkel wants to hold on to something of meaning and value. But notice that having abandoned the supernaturalism and objectivity of divine revelation in the Old Testament materials, Gunkel begins to move toward a divided field of knowledge in biblical studies, in which historical truth is separated from religious truth. Now that is important. With Gunkel, you begin to see this, a separation between historical truth and religious truth, a divided field of knowledge. Now let's move on to von Rad. Gerhard von Rad, 1901 to 1971. And still extremely influential. Hermann Gunkel's form-critical method had great influence on Gerhard von Rad of the University of Heidelberg. Developing his own unique approach to the formation of the Hexateuch and the historical books of the Old Testament, von Rad wrote a major two-volume theology of the Old Testament. And he wrote a number of commentaries, including one on Genesis and one on Deuteronomy. Von Rad's work is still highly regarded by many, and he would certainly have to be considered one of the most influential Old Testament scholars of the second half of the 20th century, and right up to the present time. The details of his approach to divine revelation in history would take far too long to discuss here in any thorough way today. But the thing that von Rad did, which is of particular significance for our own discussion, was to give the divided field of knowledge that was already discernible in Gunkel's thought much greater visibility and clarity. Von Rad distinguished between two sorts of history of Israel. For one form, he uses the German term Historie. Sounds much like our word history. Spelled H-I-S-T-O-R-I-E, history. And that has reference to modern scientific historiography that deals with history in the sense of what actually happened. That's history. But according to von Rad, this history can no longer be established from the biblical source material. You can't get back to what actually happened through the biblical source materials using this historical critical method. He says the biblical stories do not give us history, but rather they give us, and here he uses another term, Heilsgeschichte. Heils is salvation. Geschichte is another German word for history. So literally, what he says the Bible gives us is a salvation history. That is a history, he says, which is the construct and expression of Israel's faith. A history which is the construct and expression of Israel's faith. The Heilsgeschichte is, to use his own terminology, a confessional history. It's what Israel confessed to have happened. But it's not what actually happened. It is a history in which Israel expresses something of how she understood her relationship with God. And for von Rad, the history of Israel in the sense of what happened, history, and the history of Israel as formed by Israel's faith and confessed by Israel, those are two very different matters. Von Rad is concerned, note this, He is concerned only with the latter. He's not concerned with what happened. He's concerned only with the Heil's Geschichte. He's concerned with Israel's history as Israel confessed it to be. This history which is the construct and expression of her faith, not something that happened. But he's only interested in the Heil's Geschichte. Let me quote, so you get some of his own words, from his Old Testament Theology, Volume 1, page 107. He says, quote, "These two pictures of Israel's history lie before us. That of modern critical scholarship and that which the faith of Israel constructed, namely the Old Testament. And for the present, we must reconcile ourselves to both of them. The one is rational and objective. That is, with the aid of historical method and presupposing the similarity of all historical occurrence." See, that's the historical critical method. "It constructs a critical picture of the history as it really was in Israel." Now he says you really can't do much with that because you really can't get back to it. "The other," he says, "the other activity is confessional and personally involved in the events to the point of fervor. The fact that these two views of Israel's history are so divergent is one of the most serious burdens imposed today upon biblical scholarship." Now it's interesting that he senses that. It's a problem for him. Certainly a problem for me. Von Rad has no solution for that problem. But he opts to utilize the Heil's Geschichte, or the confessional history, for his own theological reflection, rather than the history, that is what actually happened. Now what you find then is this radical dualism, two different histories. And that radical dualism in Von Rad's system is a stumbling block, not only for those who take the historical trustworthiness of the Old Testament seriously, but it's a stumbling block even for many who have accepted the historical critical method. Friedrich Hesse, another German scholar, an advocate of the historical critical method, says in criticism of Von Rad, and I'll quote from him, "Our faith lives from what happened in Old Testament times, not from that which is confessed as having happened. Our faith needs to rest upon that which has actually happened, not that which is confessed to have happened, but about which we have to admit that it did not happen in that way." Now that's a good statement. Right on target. And he is correct in insisting that faith must rest on what has happened. But, as an advocate of the historical critical method himself, he too would, by means of his method, be forced to remove supernaturalism from the pages of the historical narratives of the Old Testament. He claims that the only history that has theological relevance is the history reconstructed by the historical critical method. That excludes supernaturalism. This is a history robbed of objective divine speaking and acting in human history. Now, in spite of the many variations in approach between Gunkel, Von Rad, Hesse, and a host of other scholars, it remains the case that all who adopt the historical critical method ultimately are forced into some form of humanistic religious subjectivism. Because they have rejected a priori the possibility of objective divine revelation in word and act. And if you reject that as a possibility, divine revelation in word and act, objective, you're forced into some form of humanistic religious subjectivism. That's all that's left. And Hesse, Von Rad, Gunkel, and all these other men can debate between what, how they're going to define their own position, but they're all into that subjectivistic structure in their theology.
They justify.
They can't.
There's no transformation that way. It's just an assumption. Is it because the defense of the Bible, as the passage of sad history,
that just suddenly decided it passed the threshold and give it all up?
It's a hard question to answer what goes on in the minds of a lot of these people, but I think they've become convinced of this scientific method, and then they utilize the method and that leads them in that direction. Then.
Now, among present-day young scientists that I've met, they say there's no provable God because the world is not convinced, you know, at least the majority are convinced. So, assuming that there is no God and that everything proceeds on a deterministic cause-effect basis, has given us all the technology and advance that we have. It's been a very truthful assumption that we're not going to change until you can prove otherwise. Prove like Hume with the enormous amount of proof. Maybe that's where we should head.
Certainly, of course, those arguments have been used. The fact that that assumption works certainly points in the direction that there's a designer and a creator and that these things have been put together in a way in which there is a reliability to things and a structure and design and all the rest, but
they have a very elaborately worked out things that they say you're saying their answer is you're saying the complexity requires a much higher complexity God, but then if that's so, then that complexity requires a still higher complexity of zillion infinite. So why don't we just stop at the first one? That's where I think the fulfilled prophecy argument, right?
No, well, I think that fulfilled prophecy argument is very close to this issue of divine speaking and acting because it involves both. God speaks and he acts. And you see that he says something, it comes to pass. And ultimately, you see that is extremely important. Yeah.
And it seems as though Hesse seems to be making a concession to the other fellows.
Yeah.
Not making that statement.
Yeah.
But I was wondering how a fellow like that handles scriptures. Like in Exodus, right after the Exodus in the 14th chapter there, Israel sees all the dead Egyptians on the shore.
That's it. Verse 31 there of chapter 14. Extremely important.
And he said that Israel saw that great power on the shore, and they feared the Lord, they believed him.
Yeah.
And so there's that relationship between faith and faith.
Yeah.
But he makes that concession.
Well, I don't think that's what he's... I don't think that's what he's saying. He says our faith must rest on what happened. But what you see he means by that is, let's subject that narrative and all the rest of the narratives to the historical critical method and try to get back and find out what actually happened. And when he does that, you see he's going to remove those elements. But what he objects to Von Rad doing is simply taking this confessional history and building his faith on that. He says we have to use the scientific method, get back to a reconstructed history of what actually happened and do our theologizing on that reconstructed history. Just equally as much as Von Rad, because you see, you're back into that subjectivism.
What's Hesse's name?
Friedrich, I believe, or Franz. I'm not sure which. It's F. Yeah, I think we do. Well, it depends on what churches we're in, but certainly in mainstream Protestant denominations in this country, we do see that reflected. All right, let me go a bit further. That last statement, though, I think is important. In spite of variations between all these people, and between Hesse and Von Rad, they're at each other. It remains the case that all who adopt the historical critical method ultimately are forced into some form of humanistic religious subjectivism because they've rejected a priori the possibility of objective divine revelation in word and act. There's hardly a more important issue facing the world of biblical studies today than this issue. As Gerard Hassel points out in his book, Old Testament Theology, Basic Issues in the Current Debate, page 132, he says the historical critical method requires that historical events must be capable of being explained by antecedent historical causes and understood in terms of analogy to other historical experiences. The method, which prides itself on its scientific nature and objectivity, turns out to be in the grip of its own dogmatic presuppositions and philosophical premises about the nature of history. A biblical theology which rests upon a view of history that is based on an unbroken continuum of causes and effects cannot do justice to the biblical view of history and revelation, nor to the scriptures' claim to truth. What needs to be emphatically stressed is that there is a transcendent or divine dimension in biblical history which the historical critical method is unable to deal with. And Hassell goes on to say, if all historical events must by definition be explained by sufficient historical causes, then there's no room for the acts of God in history. For God is not a historical character. If one's view of history is such that one cannot acknowledge a divine intervention in history through deed and word, then one is unable to deal adequately and properly with the testimony of Scripture. We are therefore led to conclude that the crisis respecting history and biblical theology is not so much a result of the scientific study of the evidences, but stems from the historical critical method's inadequacy to deal with the role of transcendence in history, due to its philosophical presuppositions about the nature of history. It excludes it from the outset. Now that is the issue. The God of the Bible is a God who has spoken and acted in human history to provide for the redemption of fallen man. Whenever and by whatever means God's speaking and acting in human history are denied, then inevitably the Bible's message of redemption is destroyed. The Bible unites divine revelation, redemption, and human history in such a way that any tampering with the objective historical reality of divine revelation inevitably eviscerates the Bible's message of redemption. And it's for this reason that it's so necessary for evangelical scholarship to vigorously maintain the importance of the historical trustworthiness of the Bible. The history of the Bible is the history of redemption. Question.
Now I see the reason for the success of home churches and what's happening in groups that are reading.
They're getting back to the Bible and they're taking it at face value for what it's. That's right. That's right.
And moving in power, growing in faith within the framework of what God
has said and accepting that. Unfortunately, we find that some who consider themselves to be within the evangelical community have made significant concessions to the historical critical method, and have even moved toward accepting a divided field of knowledge in biblical studies, which I might say is unavoidable when one tries to fuse the historical critical method with traditional biblical teaching. You can't do it. And if you start accepting elements of the historical critical method, you're going to ultimately end up in this divided field of knowledge. Now, the certain result of such a position will be the increasing erosion of confidence in biblical historicity and a consequent loss of authenticity and authority for the Bible's message of redemption. That's what's at stake. As J. Gresham Machen said in his inaugural address as assistant professor of New Testament literature and exegesis at Princeton Seminary on May 3rd, 1915, 70 years ago, he said the separation of Christianity from history has been a great concern of modern theology. It has been an inspiring attempt, but it has been a failure. Give up history and you can retain some things. You can retain belief in God, but philosophical theism has never been a powerful force in the world. You can retain a lofty ethical idea, but be perfectly clear about one point. You can never retain a gospel. For gospel means good news, tidings, information about something that has happened. In other words, it means history. A gospel independent of history is simply a contradiction in terms. End of quote. J. Gresham Machen, in his inaugural address in 1950. Praise be to God, who has spoken and acted in history to provide for our redemption, and who has given us a trustworthy record of all that he has done that is contained in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. Now that's the end of my formal comments. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to attempt to respond to them. I thought I would use a transparency here to try to help you not only hear but also see something of these viewpoints of Wellhausen, Gunkel, and Von Rad. I didn't do that. I don't know if there's interest in looking back at that. But are there any questions at this point? Yes.
So you were talking
about
the overhead.
Yeah. I'll put it up here. It could be copied on the copy machine in the library. Let me just go over this. Religious value of the Old Testament. First, a biblical position. I don't know if I can do any better, you know. Religious value of the Old Testament. Biblical position. Religious value is in the relationship established between God and his people. This relationship is constituted in the interplay of revelation by word and deed and faith. Now, in the diagram, if you put God here, you put history down here. You have revelation by word and act that enters human history. And you have faith, which is the response of that, to that. God speaks and he acts, man responds. That's faith. It's a response to divine revelation. And so you have that relationship established between God and man. As God speaks and acts, man responds. And the religious value is in that relationship that becomes established between God and his people, and that relationship is constituted in this interplay of revelation and faith. Now it seems to me that that's the basic structure that we find in the scripture with respect to divine revelation, human response, and religious significance and meaning and value. Now, when you come to Wellhausen, let me push this up a bit. When you come to Wellhausen, I think all you can put is an X. The basis for faith and revelation is gone. And religious value is destroyed. And for Wellhausen, there wasn't really interest in what the religious value of the Old Testament was or its meaning for us. You see, the interest was replaced by something quite different. The interest is in the history of the evolution of Israel's religion. And what he wanted to try to do was reconstruct the evolutionary development of Israel's religion from primitive to more complex forms of worship. And in doing that, he completely rewrote the Old Testament. He put the prophets before the law. Moses was late, quote, the material that's ascribed to Moses was late. The prophets were the great innovators of ethical monotheism. And all that material we have in Genesis, for the most part, came from the exile and later. And totally untrustworthy as far as history is concerned. So his interest was in the history of the evolution of Israel's religion. It's a history of religions kind of approach and interest. It's not something that gives us any religious value or meaning. So it's pretty well destroyed with Wellhausen. Questions?
Would you say then these sources of the signs, dates to, and so forth are really arbitrarily set? There is no historic document of any kind to say these ever existed?
No, there is absolutely no evidence that any of those documents, in quotes, ever existed in a separate form. There's no evidence of that. His dating of that material is also quite arbitrary. It's arranged in order to exhibit this evolutionary development. Yeah, absolutely.
In other words, he has no historical basis, really, and biblical documents are still available.
That's right. All right. To move to Gunkel, the stories of the Old Testament, according to Gunkel, are poetic expressions of the people and contain great religious ideas. See, he was interested in this oral tradition form behind the written form, behind the documents of Wellhausen. The stories, according to Gunkel, are filtered through a screen of time and transformation. So if you want to talk about history in the sense of what happened, you can look at this dotted line down. That's hard to detect because it's hard to get back to. Because it's hard to detect, according to Gunkel, in the written traditions. The Old Testament history, what happened, is not important to Gunther. The message of the stories is. So what happened is kind of sketchy down here in this bottom line, but these stories filtered through a screen of time and transformation is what you get up here, deposited in the Bible. And he says what is important is what religious message or meaning can be derived from these stories, not what happened. We can't really get back very well to what happened. So that's an attempt to diagram it. But the stories are poetic expressions of the people. They contain great religious ideas. They tell us very little about what happened. You may be able to get bits and pieces here and there. When you get to Von Raab, you see, with Gunkel, I said you begin to move into this divided field of knowledge of religious truth and historical truth. When you get to Von Raab, that is quite sharp and explicit. Because with Von Raab, you can draw a solid line. History is down here in the bottom. What happened? Little or nothing can be known. And he's really not interested in that. You see, this is what you would try to get at through utilization of the historical critical method. You apply that to the Old Testament materials, but the materials are so transformed through time and change and through legendary accretions and all that kind of thing, you really can't get much of what actually happened. But he's not interested in that. What he is interested in, interestingly enough, is the Old Testament as we have it. But you see, the Old Testament as we have it, he says, is not telling us what happened. The history of the Old Testament as we have it is the expression of Israel's faith. It's an expression of how she expressed her relationship and understanding of that relationship with God. And it's a construct of faith. It's a confessional history. It's all up here. That's Heilsgeschichte. You can put faith up here on this top line and say that faith, with these lines going down, produces the history, the Heilsgeschichte. The faith produces the history. Because the history is the expression of the faith. Now, these two disciplines, according to Von Raab, are to be kept separate as two parallel lines. You don't ever intermix these two. You know, what happened and what is confessed to have happened. They have nothing to do with each other. He's only interested in what's here. Now, you've noticed I've put this line, I've put this up on top. Those of you who have read Francis Schaeffer's materials probably know he uses the expression upper and lower story. Well, Von Raab's interested only in the upper story in terms of Francis Schaeffer. You see, that is something that is subjective. That is something that has to do with religious experience. What's the lower story has to do with objective historical reality, something that's scientific and rational and provable and demonstrable. Well, he radically separates those two. He deals with this. But then you see, to add to the confusion, what happens is, if you read, at least in certain sections of Von Raab's Old Testament theology, he is dealing with the material as it was confessed to have happened. And at that point, some of his insights are very little different than what yours or mine might be, and sometimes are helpfully. But you see, underneath it, there's no foundation. There's no base, because he doesn't believe any of it happened.
No, you were inspired.
No. At least not in the sense that the scripture itself would represent itself to have been inspired. Yeah.
I'm German, I'm a little German language. And I know that Shakespeare is a story on the same level as you might say Aesop's Fables.
Yeah.
And that's the level that he's putting on.
That's exactly it.
Now there are some truths.
That's right.
And that's where it's the truth.
Mm-hmm. But there's no more authority to it than Aesop's Fables. That's right. And you're back into this subjectivism of human religious ideas. You see, that objective divine revelation, speaking and acting, has been removed. Yes?
To give a temporary illustration, I think I was listening to a tape on evangelism by one of our prominent denominations, and the speaker was speaking on evangelism, and he was quoting particular individuals, and he brought out how that evangelicals get hung up on incidentals like the inerrancy of Scripture. He says, who cares whether it really happened or not? He said, we have to give the message. Mm-hmm. What message do you have?
Precisely.
You have no fact.
Yeah, and the point is, the general public can see that, and they're not going to buy that kind of a message. Yeah.
Except he's not. He was speaking to the conference of pastors, and of course, that doesn't filter down to the public.
That's true. That's true. That's true. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
Dr. Bell, I'm very interested in what your opinion is in 1 Corinthians in addressing this dilemma that we have in verse 10 of chapter 18, when it says that when that which is perfect is come, and that which is in part shall be done away. Could that be a promise that the Lord really will righteous and that the day of his coming and
yeah, I certainly think at that point it will be clear that these theories were unfounded and mistaken. And the Lord will demonstrate in that day very clearly that he had spoken and he had acted, and therefore man is responsible and accountable. And of course that's the seriousness of it, because those who have not responded, or that those or those who have turned away from that, certainly will stand in judgment for that. Yep.
Some of the people who have told us that I've met say it's impossible to believe until you solve the problems. There's only one more problem. That's why I wonder, instead of trying to meet them by throwing at the solution to every problem, if it would not be tactically better to go for the evidence and go for the hypothesis and say, now there are always problems, just like in science, you do more research. But we do have enough reason to believe in the unity of truth and the principle of the hypothesis of God. And then we have the time to solve the problem, but we don't have to be anxious about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right. I don't think, you know, there are plenty of problems that we cannot always solve, and it's human nature and tendency to focus on those things and then to obscure the real issues. So I certainly think that prophecy and fulfillment is a strong argument. It points to the existence and power and veracity of the God who has spoken and acted in history. As strong an argument as you can have. Fine.
You have a problem with the mic, but it's a way for particular. Mm-hmm.
I don't think, I think you won't come to a view of the authority and inerrancy of Scripture by having solved all the problems and leading it. You will not come that way. No, I agree with that. Okay, I'll conclude with this. Okay.